This is Audible.
Wolf Hunt by Graham McNeil. Performed by Gareth Armstrong, Jane Collingwood, Jonathan Keeble, Luke Thompson, and David Timpson. Directed by Samuel Gunn. Produced by Heavy Entertainment for Black Library.
Yasu Nagasena stands by a window of the square tower at the northeastern corner of his mountain villa, letting the cold cut into his face. Built on the flanks of a mountain known as Cho Oyu, the villa has been his home for 50 years, and memories surround him like restless ghosts. Mournful winds from the far corners of the world sigh through the tower, each bearing the sound of pounding hammers, a billion migrant voices, and the fear of an entire planet. The mountains crowd this continent, rowdy giants standing shoulder to shoulder as they reach to the heavens. Sunlight spills over them in a golden tide, gleaming from the exposed quartz and feldspar. The mountains are saying goodbye, giving him a last sight of their glory. The villa looks out over the palace at the crown of the world. Through the windows he can see its triumphal processionals and its freshly wrought defenses. Beyond the palace walls, the petitioner's city. Once a place of pilgrimage, now an overcrowded slum of people desperate to find protection. Nagasena turns from the window. The Emperor is remaking the galaxy, but Rogel Dorn is remaking the palace. Once it was a thing of beauty, but it is ugly now. The craft of the engineer pasted over the vision of the architect.
It is not an harmonious union, Lord Dorn.
He has spoken little since the end of his hunt for the escaped warriors of the Crusader host. What began as a hunt ended in sanctioned murder. Nagasena hears the slap of sandals on the marbled stairs, accompanied by the heaving breath of Amita. She has maintained his household for as long as he has lived here, and is as robust and solid as the mountains. Amita reaches the top of the tower, her skin ruddy from the climb, and strands of grey-streaked hair hanging loose over her face. She frowns at Nagasena's clothes, a lacquered breastplate of blackened bronze, reinforced canvas leggings tucked into leather-faced boots.
You asked to see me?
He nods, looking back down over the sprawling immensity of the palace. Far below, a towering siege titan is lifting vast ouslite blocks from the Dawalagiri elevation, the workmanship too precious to be destroyed or built over. He wonders if that stone will ever see the light of day again.
Yes, I have something to give you.
Here?
No, in my private chambers.
Oh, you couldn't have summoned me there instead of making me climb all these stairs.
My apologies, Amita. I lingered here longer than I intended.
That doesn't make my old bones feel any better.
Nagasena smiles. In any other household, Amita's brusqueness would see her dismissed. But her blunt honesty matches his adherence to the truth over all things.
Have I been a good master to serve?
Nagasena likes the fact that she takes the time to think about her answer, instead of simply voicing a platitude.
You have always been courteous and grateful. The staff think you cold, but you are just sorrowful. More so now.
Nagasena nods. It is a fair assessment.
Come with me.
He moves past her to begin the long descent of the tower. Amita follows, and they emerge into the rose garden where he wishes he could have spent more time. They follow the hypaethral walkway around the garden and into the well-proportioned chambers of the villa. He opens the doors to his private chambers and beckons Amita to enter. She reluctantly follows him within, barely registering the silk-hanging scrolls depicting ancient maps of long-forgotten realms. Atlantia, Hyperborea, and Dalriada. Nagasena makes his way to shelves laden with papers and heavy textbooks. He pulls out a wax-sealed document and sits cross-legged behind his narrow desk. He beckons Amita to sit as he breaks the seal. Nagasena dips a sharpened eagle feather in a pot of ink and signs his name at the bottom of the document. He turns the paper around and holds the quill out to Amita.
Sign your name next to mine, and you will be the owner of this villa.
You're giving me the villa?
Yes.
Why?
You have more than earned it.
Amita does not reach for the quill.
You are going on another hunt?
I am.
Nagasena places the quill on the desk. He rises smoothly and runs his hand over the wall behind him in a series of complex gestures. It slides back, revealing a deep compartment filled with gleaming armor and racked weapons. It is an armory worthy of a Legion quartermaster.
Who is it this time?
Nagasena removes a hand-tooled longlas and a silver-chased Vulkite pistol, weapons capable of harming the man he is to hunt. These are not implements of pursuit and capture, but execution.
A Lunar Wolf.
A warrior of the Legions?
A warrior of Horus.
He slings the long las over his shoulder and holsters the pistol before reverently lifting a scabbard of lacquered wood, jade, and mother-of-pearl from a rack of rich cherry wood. The sword's handle is wound in leather of the palest cream, and its blade was crafted with love and an attention to detail that no machine will ever replicate. Nagasena knows the weapon as Shujiki.
You do not expect to return?
A reasonable expectation.
Who gives you this hunt?
Lord Dawn.
She nods, knowing Nagasena could not have refused a Primarch's order.
If I am to die on this hunt, I do not wish to leave loose ends in my wake. The villa is to be yours. This is my wish.
Amita pushes the document away.
If I am told you are dead, I will sign it. But not before.
Nagasena is humbled by her fierce devotion and belts Shujiki around his waist. His hand settles naturally on the textured grip.
Sign it. Even if I kill this man, I do not think I will return.
Why not?
Because the mountains have said goodbye.
Amita nods, accepting his cryptic answer.
This Lunar Wolf, does he have a name?
His name is Severian.
The wolf was in the fold, but none of the sheep suspected he was there. The Hab tenement in which Severian made his lair existed in a perpetual state of incremental collapse. Tremors shook the dust from its walls with every hammer blow of titanic machinery on the construction fields before the palace. 2,000 people crowded the building, taking what privacy they could with tarpaulins hung on a complex web of intersecting clotheslines. Severian was a ghost, unseen and unheard over the building's moans. 3 days he had hidden between the walls and in the rotting ceiling spaces of the tenement, listening to the static hiss in his helmet and fighting the urge to keep moving. The hunters expected him to flee the slaughter at the Temple of Woe, but stillness was his cloak now, not action. Hundreds of black sentinels had flooded the city, sweeping through the despairing streets in search of him. He had seen no sign of imperial fists or custodians. What could be important enough to keep them from the hunt? The mortal soldiers moved through the city like beaters on a game hunt, but it was simplicity itself to evade them.
These men had never hunted a lunar wolf before. And they... No, not a lunar wolf. A son of Horus. The Warmaster was no stranger to the value of ego displays, but even he had balked at the renaming of an entire Space Marine Legion in his honor. It seemed that his reluctance had now been overcome. Severian still thought of himself as a lunar wolf, the lone predator hunting in the gloaming light of the moon. A son of Horus would fight his way through this city, but only a lunar wolf could pass unknown through its streets. He still wore the armor he had stripped from the Thunder Warrior's enforcers. The plates were ill-fitting, fashioned in an age where immediacy was a greater concern than functionality. The helm fox buzzed with static, bubbling with ghost voices of long-dead warriors. He could tune out the static, but it was harder to ignore the voices of the people around him. The subject on everyone's lips was the Warmaster's rebellion and the massacre on Istvan V. Trembling mouths told and retold tales of murder and atrocity. Lies and speculation masqueraded as fact. But every tale-teller agreed that Horus Lupercal was a betrayer, a vile and faithless son. Severian could not bring himself to believe his Primarch had turned against the Emperor. What reason could the Warmaster have to embark upon such a calamitous course? Severian could think of nothing grand enough to warrant betrayal, his mind rejecting every possibility as too petty, too improbable, or too mortal to justify a galaxy-wide rebellion. A father had seemed so certain of Horus's betrayal, but that was always the way with the Crimson King's sons. They lived for certainty, but a father was dead, a Primarch's bullet in his brain. What did his certitudes count for now? Severian heard the crunch of approaching footsteps and slowed his breathing, letting himself merge with the rotting lath and plaster of the ceiling. The footsteps stopped beneath him. Three men carrying plastic drums to be filled with water from the pump. Severian's ability to remain hidden in plain sight was superlative. An affinity with shadows that came to him as naturally as breathing. It was a risk, concealing himself in an area frequented by the people that called this block home, but the risks were outweighed by the morsels of information he could gather. The first man, thick-set and with the build of a metalworker, placed his drum beneath the pump and began working the handle. The water that came out was brackish-looking and gritty. The other men took turns at the pump, and their talk was banal and mundane. Inevitably, their discussion turned towards the fighting in the Istvan system.
It was that bastard Horus. He's the one that started this. Changing the name of his legion like that. Too big an ego, that one, and no mistake.
A skeletal man with eyes as big as saucers and whose sweat stank of an addict's hunger took his place at the pump.
I reckon you're right.
A balding man with a hooked nose and a withered right arm was last at the pump.
What did the Emperor expect? I mean, you give a man that much power, it's bound to go to his head.
The men nodded at the sagacity of their companion.
Yeah, you get that many guns and all you want to do is shoot them off, right? Like, look at Istvan III, wiped out with virus bombs. Madness.
I heard Horus killed three of his brothers single-handed. Vulcan, Korax, and Lehman Russ. All dead as dust. Mm.
The Wolf King weren't on Istvan. It's Ferus Manus that's dead. They say the Phoenician killed him, cut his head right off.
Nah, I don't reckon anyone could kill that tough old bastard. Got bones of iron, he has. How are you going to cut through that?
Well, Horus could do it. Got bad blood in him, hasn't he? Mm. Everyone says so. I heard he got poisoned.
Hey?
Some cult got him sick and twisted his mind. Shura says she heard Horus is one of this cult now. Him and all his warriors. They sacrifice women and children, I hear. Throw them into the fires and let them burn in the name of some god or other.
Mm.
The man leaned in conspiratorially.
Yeah, no better than savages now, she says. Cannibals they are, eating the flesh of the dead and making trophies from their bones.
Severian ground his teeth. to hear his beloved Primarch and Legion being slandered with such obvious nonsense was almost more than he could stand. His fingers tightened on the rusting rebars and pipes, and the metal squealed as it buckled beneath his strength. The metal worker looked up, and their eyes met through the sodden ceiling structure. Severian willed the man not to see him, focusing every ounce of his determination. The man looked away, with a curious expression on his face, as though suddenly bewildered. Severian exhaled softly, seeing his breath feather the air in front of him.
I heard that said too. They say Aurus has gone mad, that he's been, you know, possessed. Possessed?
Yeah, you know, by aliens or something.
Severian could stand it no longer and dropped to the floor with a heavy crash.
Throne.
The metalworker and the addict jumped back from the pump in shock, but the balding man turned tail and ran for his life. Severian's hand shot out and a piece of brickwork no larger than a pebble flashed from his palm. It struck the balding man like a bullet from a slingshot. The impact spun him around and he collapsed with an egg-sized lump on the back of his skull. Drool and blood leaked from the corner of his mouth.
You killed him?
No.
Severian drew the serrated knife belted at his hip.
Though he deserves death for disrespecting the War Master.
You're him, ain't you? You're the one they're all looking for.
Severian ignored him.
You're like ignorant children. You know nothing of Lord Horus, the battles he won, and the blood he spilled for his father. My legion waged war across the heavens for 200 years, conquering the galaxy in the name of humanity, and this is the thanks we get. I should kill you all.
No.
You ought to be building statues of the War Master and shrines to his deeds. Horus has won the galaxy for you, not the Emperor.
The addict crumpled to his knees, weeping and pawing at Severian's boots. The Lunar Wolf kicked him away in disgust, drawing a cry of pain from the man's lips. The metalworker swallowed hard and looked up at Severian.
Horus is a traitor. The Emperor said so.
Severian's fist drew back, his arm quivering with tension. One tap, and the man's skull would be in 100 fragments.
The War Master is the Emperor's beloved son. These things you say, they cannot be true. I would know of it.
The metalworker fell to his knees, with his hands laced before him as though in prayer. His terror sickened Severian. The emotion was too unknown to him, and made Severian want to kill him even more.
You are what we fought for.
He leant down and placed the tip of the knife against the man's chest.
Your kind doesn't deserve to inherit the galaxy. Your life isn't worth one drop of Legion blood.
Oh, please, please don't kill me.
Severian sheathed his knife and looked at the man with the eyes of a god who stared upon his failed creation. He turned away in disgust. Robbed of certainty, and adrift on unknown tides. The light was falling away to evening as Severian left the Hab tenement. He moved through narrow streets taken by decay, avoiding the thoroughfares and arteries of the petitioner's city. Every junction would have a complement of soldiers stationed at its corners and rooftops. A lone wolf, he owned the silence and made the shadows his own. There were few people abroad in these narrow alleyways, only the occasional footpad or lost soul, and they wisely kept out of his way. He did not kill as he went. A body was a trail, but a frightened man kept his own counsel. The heavy-handed approach of the soldiers sweeping the streets was working in Severian's favor. Word of the Black Sentinel's brutal search tactics had spread quickly, and now no one was admitting to anything. They had no clue where he was heading. The villa of the Emperor's War Mason was a shining bauble atop the granite scarp above the Temple of Woe. Severian's route had taken him in a looping course away from his pursuers and back around to where he had begun, ready to climb that cliff to where the War Mason kept his orbit-capable flyer. Vadok Singh, like many of his gene-bred bloodline, favored elevated positions from which to observe his works. And it was from here that Sir Varian would begin his journey back to his legion. To prove the falsehood of the accusations leveled against his Primarch, or to call him to account for his crimes. Sir Varian paused at an irregular confluence of narrow streets. He pressed himself to the wall as he heard the tramp of booted feet from his left. Muffled voices echoed with a curious metallic quality from the walls, and Sir Varian picked out five speakers. A combat squad, which meant there was likely another one nearby. Sir Varian crouched like a runner awaiting the starting pistol and closed his eyes, letting his hearing take up the sensory slack. There, behind him, moving through the building to his rear, they moved carefully, which meant they knew he was nearby.
Request immediate backup.
Moisture dripped from above, and Severian looked up to see a young girl leaning from a scaffolded trellis, dressed in a simple green shift with a red flower pinned to her breast. She saw him and waved. Severian watched the play of muscles around her mouth and knew she was about to call out to him. His hand closed on a sharp-edged rock. He could put it through her skull before she spoke, angling his throw so she would fall back into her dwelling. Instead, he lifted a finger to his lips and shook his head. He saw panic in her eyes as she retreated into the building and shook his head in disbelief. Legion warriors were avatars of battle, but when had they become figures of fear to human beings? He remembered the cheering multitudes at the expeditionary fields as the marching hosts of space marines had left for a life of war. The crowds had laughed and cheered them. But those days were gone. Now, they were murderous killers. Savage weapons that could turn and blood their creators as easily as their foes. The spaces between the buildings were hung with wet sheets, like the battle flags won by the Legion in its earliest days. The reclamation of the asteroid belt, the taking of the outer planets, and the first push out into wilderness space. How many more victory banners were now hung in the Museum of Conquest aboard the Vengeful Spirit? What glories had passed Severian by as he rotted on Terra, as little more than a figurehead of wars he would never fight? He let out a soft sigh, forcing down the random jumping of his thoughts when there was killing in the offing. He calculated the distance between him and the first man in the approaching squad. Severian counted down until a booted foot and the wavering barrel of a carbine appeared around the corner. He swung out, keeping the Black Sentinel's body between him and the rest of the squad. Pistoning jab crushed the man's skull. He spun around the falling body, going low and swinging his leg out in a scything sweep that felled the two soldiers behind him. They dropped, and Severian slammed his fists against their chests, smashing their ribs down through their lungs and stealing the air from their screams. He sprang forwards and chopped his hands out, hard left, hard right. The two soldiers bringing up the rear of the squad toppled, their necks broken cleanly. Severian heard the bark of urgent voices and the vox beads clipped to their helmets. He lifted one of the tiny voice units to his mouth.
Five dead and counting. Who wants to be number six?
When Nagasena reaches the bodies, ragged scavengers have already begun to gather. They look at him with hostile eyes, debating whether or not to fight him for possession of the dead. He already knows they will make the wrong decision. After all, desperation makes fools of men. There are five of them. More than enough, they think, to take down one man. Two are armed with factory-stamped stubbers. The third with a custom rig that looks more dangerous to its owner than him. Two men rush him, armed only with lengths of rusted pipe and fearborn courage. Chujiki whispers from its sheath, and the first dies with his belly sliced open. Nagasena spins on his heel and brings the lethal edge down on the neck of the second. The head flies clear and crashes through a nearby window. Nagasena is moving before the first body hits the ground. Stubber fire blasts from perforated barrels. The low-grade ammo makes the gun's recoil too powerful to keep the weapon on target. Two quick cuts open the first gunner from groin to sternum. Nagasena leaps up, and his sword stabs down into the hollow behind the second gunner's collarbone. It slices effortlessly through the man's heart and lungs. Nagasena twists the blade free, and a crimson geyser arcs over the wall as the man falls to his knees. The last scavenger backs away, his converted pistol held out in a shaking grip. It is a primitive thing. Loud, dangerous, and intimidatingly large. Nagasena's pistol matches it in lethality, but his does not waver.
You will miss, and then I will kill you.
He sees the man's decision in his eyes, a fraction of a second before he knows it himself. Nagasena presses the firing stud on his Volkite pistol, and a searing beam flashes into existence, linking the tapered barrel and the scavenger's head. The man's skull detonates as his brain cavity is superheated and the blood, oxygen, and brain matter expand explosively. His headless corpse drops straight down and his finger tightens on the trigger. The report echoes through the streets of the petitioner's city, and Nagasena feels the distortion of the air as the shell tears past him to blow a shield-sized crater in the wall behind him. He holsters his pistol and bends to wipe the blood from Shujiki on a dead man's clothes. With the worst of it removed, Nagasena unfolds an oiled cloth and polishes the blade to a mirror finish once again. He brings the blade up and touches the tip to the end of the scabbard. He pauses, a heartbeat, to honor the weapon before sliding it home in one smooth motion. He hears angry voices behind him. Men who wear the same uniform as the Black Sentinels killed by Severian. A five-man combat squad, the brothers of these dead Sentinels. A lieutenant reaches down to a fallen warrior, and Nagasena opens his mouth to shout a warning, but it is too late. The dead man's body shifts, and the fragmentation grenades, wedged between his breastplate and the ground, roll clear. Nagasena hurls himself behind a stack of crumbling bricks as they detonate with a hard, echoing bang. Fire rolls out, and in its wake comes a storm of red-hot shrapnel. It engulfs the street, ricocheting back and forth in a flesh-shredding hurricane. The blast wave lifts the other dead bodies into the air, and grenades hidden beneath them go off in a deafening succession of secondary explosions. Nagasena puts his hands to his ears, pressing himself into a tight ball as the concussive force of the blasts punches the air from his lungs. Tumbling fragments of hot steel slice his cheek, his arm, and his neck. One embeds in Shujiki's scabbard, and he plucks the smoking metal from the lacquered wood. At last, the ringing echoes of the blast diminish as it travels outward through the streets. He sucks in a breath of physalene hot air. Blood runs down his face and from his ears. His body feels like it has been worked over by an arbiter's shock maul. Nagasena rises unsteadily to his feet, but he can see nothing of the sentinels. He weaves a path back down the street, seeing dark, wet lumps that were once human beings, scattered like butcher's offal. The smoke obscures the worst of the carnage, but not enough to keep the horror from his face. One man is still alive. Incredibly, it is the lieutenant who turned over the first grenade-rigged body. Nothing is left of him below the waist, and he stares at Nagasena with pleading, disbelieving eyes. His mouth flaps like a landed fish, trying to form words, but failing in the face of such unendurable agony. Nagasena kneels beside the lieutenant and takes his hand. The lieutenant's eyes ease shut as though he is falling asleep. And might soon wake. The man's hand slips from Nagasena's, who gives voice to the Jisei composed by Master Nagamitsu on the eve of his assassination.
Should this body die, and die a thousand times over, white bones turning to dust, with or without trace of a soul, my steadfast heart is truth. Can it ever fade away?
Nagasena looks up, feeling someone's gaze upon him. Leaning from a high window of an adjacent building is a young girl, strikingly pretty, with skin so dark it puts him in mind of the salamander's legionary he saw at the preceptory. Her eyes are wide orbs of pale white, and she wears a crimson flower pinned to her green dress. She sees him looking at her and darts her head back inside. The instant their eyes meet, Nagasena sees a sure and certain truth. She has seen the Lunar Wolf. Severian moved at speed through the streets, following the mental map he had compiled in the hours after his escape from the Temple of Woe. The street plan followed no logic and changed with each passing day, but he navigated the spaces between its scrapyard palaces and junk habs with aplomb. Like his ability to blend, his innate sense for direction had never yet let him down. He had guided the outcast dead through the labyrinthine complexity of the mountain jail with ease, and they had traveled the petitioner's city like natives. Cities opened up to Severian, their roads rising to greet him, their highways and byways like old friends. Frightened faces poked from openings in scavenged structures above him, some seeing him, most not. Even those that looked right at him did so with perplexed expressions, as though unsure of what exactly they were seeing. Severian did not question this. The shadows were lengthening, and Severian kept to the walls, moving low and keeping his eyes constantly in motion. The noise of the city was familiar to him, a rustle of bodies, the clatter of pots and the sharpening of knives. Then came the dull echoes of distant grenade blasts, and he shook his head at the foolishness of his pursuers. Cook fires and smoke scents joined those of sweat and desperation and fear, and beneath it all, the low-level buzz of the broken earpiece in his helmet. He'd listened to the skirl and sway of the static during the quieter moments of his solitude, picking out the odd word here and there, like impossibly distant echoes from a bygone age, seeking a connection to the present. Nothing of any use. But the interleaving ghost voices made him feel marginally less isolated. He wondered if he would eventually join them. A lone voice lost among the millions of dead in the wars fought to bring unity to a world on the verge of extinction. A static warble, like a soft wave breaking on a golden beach, washed through the helm, and Severian let the vox fragments surf the edges of his consciousness as he slipped through the evening. He crested a rocky defile towards the scarp upon which rested Vadok Singh's walled enclosure. He skirted the edges of what looked like a small cemetery, the three graves hacked from the rock of the mountain and marked with carved cherubs. Severian saw no names, but from the size of the holes cut into the rock, two of the dead were children. He looked back through the jumbled silhouettes of the buildings behind him, seeing the arched roof of the Temple of Woe. Despite the wild stories of what had taken place within its walls, the people of the petitioner's city still brought their dead to its doors. No one would dig a grave for Severian. And the thought hardened his heart. He began to climb. Nagasena looks for a way into the building, eventually finding a rope-hinged doorway of nailed timbers and sheet metal. He pauses as he enters, letting his eyes adjust to the dim light. Stairs lead to a broken landing, upon which sits an ill-fashioned ladder of metal struts and baling twine. Swiftly he ascends, knowing he does not have much time, until mistrust seals the girl's lips. The floor above is a crumbling permacrete slab, divided into myriad living spaces by struts of trench shuttering. Huddled bodies crouch in their allocated spaces, gathered around stuttering thermal generators, sleeping or kneeling before opened boxes with carved fronts. Children look at him with open mouths before parents pull them away. They do not know him, but they know he is dangerous. These people are pinched and wary, curious at the bloodshed beyond their home, but hoping he will pass swiftly. He is an unwelcome visitor in a place he does not belong. The sensation of being a trespasser on Terra saddens him, and he wonders if these people even think of themselves as citizens of the Imperium anymore. He sees the girl in the green dress, sitting with her back to the wall, her knees drawn up before her, and he makes his way towards her, slowly. She looks 20, but is probably younger. Poverty and desperation age people. He keeps his hands in plain sight, palms up. She watches him with eyes that tell him she saw him kill the scavengers.
You have nothing to fear from me.
You promise?
Her desire to believe him almost breaks his heart. Nagasena twists the sash at his waist, holding the lacquered scabbard as though offering it to her. Her eyes widen at the workmanship, and he knows she will never see anything this beautiful again.
This sword is Shujiki. In one of the dead languages, it means honesty. The man who gave it that name bound it to me with a promise to live by that principle. I am not a good man, and I have done many terrible things in my life, but I have never broken that promise.
She searches his face for deceit, but finds none, and the tension in her taut body visibly relaxes.
You saw him, the Legion warrior.
Her face crumples at the memory, and Nagasena waits, knowing it would be a mistake to force the words from her. To see a space marine is no small thing, and to see one make war is to witness killing fury at its most violent.
He is not coming back, if that is what you are afraid of.
You don't know that. I saw him look at me, and he had death in his eyes.
A single tear runs down her cheek, and Nagasena hates that the treachery of Horus has made this girl afraid of the very warriors wrought to win the galaxy in her name.
He will never hurt you.
How do you know that?
Because I am going to kill him.
She looks up, and she gives him a crooked grin at the certainty in his voice.
My name's Akata. He went north, towards the cliffs above the Temple of Woe.
At first, Nagasena thinks she must be mistaken. Why would Severian head back to where the hunt began? Then he remembers what Severian wants, and it all makes sense.
Does that help you?
More than you know.
Coming to a decision within himself, he removes a jade cartouche from around his neck. The polished oval stone is etched in gold with the image of a serpentine dragon. He places the cartouche in Ekata's palm and closes her fingers over it.
Do you know the Chitwan path on the southern approaches to the upland work camps?
Yes, at the Primus Gate barracks.
Take the path until you come to a fork marked with a small cairn of black and gold rocks. Walk the path on your right and follow it uphill until you reach a red-roofed villa with the same dragon symbol on the gates. Present yourself to the mistress of the house, a woman named Amita, and tell her that Master Nagamitsu's pupil wishes you to be treated as a guest until his return. You understand?
Yes.
Her smile makes her beautiful.
Go now, for night is coming, and the petitioner's city is no place to be after dark.
Ekata stands and unpins the crimson flower from her breast and leans forward to attach it to Nagasena's breastplate.
For luck, a rosette.
Severian had chosen a route up the eastern sides of projecting bluffs of the cliff face to keep himself clad in shadows. The climb was difficult, the exposed face worn smooth by abrasive winds and the quarryman's drill. Each handhold was a finger breadth wide, each toehold a sliver of a projection. More than enough for a lunar wolf. The sun arced further into the west, the rich blue deepening to subtle purple, and the sounds of the city rising to meet him. As the sun dipped to the horizon, the palace was bathed in its dying light, painting it the color of blood. Severian remembered a time before it had assumed so imperious a title and appearance, when it had been no more than a mountain citadel, a bastion for a council of war, a fastness from which the conquest of the galaxy had been planned. It had been a time for heroes, the beginning of a new epoch. For the first time in uncounted centuries, light was eclipsing dark. The solar system was poised to fall, and the galaxy was opening up to mankind. In a mighty diaspora that echoed humanity's first great explosion into the stars, the expeditionary fleets of the legions knifed into the void to reclaim that lost empire. But Severian would not be part of that noble endeavor. As the 63rd expedition breached the heliopause, Severian was returning to Terra with full honors to join the Crusader host. As part of a new brotherhood, he had stood proudly with his brother legionaries in glory. They had been visible paragons of the new order, carving the Imperium into the flesh of the galaxy. That time was long gone, and Severian found it increasingly difficult to reconcile that memory with his current plight. Stranded and alone, the last survivor of a disparate group of warriors thrown together by circumstance, then chosen by Atharva's design. He had long ago given up trying to understand why Atharva had only freed the seven of them, when there were plainly others who would have been sympathetic to their cause. What of the representatives of the Night Lords, the Word Bearers, and the Iron Warriors? Might their escape have fared better with a son of Nostramo or an Olympian at their side? At first, Severian didn't notice the scratching voice emerging from the static, thinking it was simply his imagination, a trick of memory and isolation. But it came again, rising like a whisper in the quiet of a deserted fane. He paused in his ascent and tapped a finger to the side of the helm. The voice came again, louder and more distinct. This time, there was no question of what it was saying.
Severian.
Shock pinned him to the cliff. He twisted his head left and right, then up and down. He saw nothing to indicate he was being observed. But any hunter this good wouldn't expose himself to his prey.
Severian.
Who are you?
My name is Yasu Nagasena.
You are the hunter who tracked us to the temple.
Yes, and now I have tracked you here.
How is it you are talking to me?
The helmet you wear belonged to a warrior from an earlier age. I saw how your fellow warriors were clad in the temple and requisitioned a similar communications device from the palace reliquaries.
Clever.
It required no great insight on my part.
No one else thought of it.
I am not everyone else.
Severian tried to recall what he knew of Unity tech levels. He smiled.
You won't be triangulating me with this. These work on open wavelength broadcasts. Anyone with a receiver tuned to the right frequency could hear this.
I do not need to track you this way. I know where you are going and have you in my sights right now.
Severian laughed, the first moment of genuine amusement he had felt in a long time.
Then take the shot, Hunter.
Moments later, a portion of the cliff face to his left puffed with the impact of a long-lens round. Severian blinked away the after-image and the acrid heat haze of dust.
Are you psychic? Has the Imperium decided that yet another class of useful psychers are worth special dispensation?
Nagasena seemed amused at his outburst.
I am not psychic, just a very good tracker. The first axiom of the tracker is to understand what your target wants.
And what do I want?
What death denied Athava of the Thousand Suns and your fellows. The truth.
Severian paused in his climb.
What truth?
The truth of how the galaxy has changed. You are adrift, Severian. You are told your Primarch has betrayed you. Betrayed the Imperium. You want to look your brothers in the eye because you cannot reconcile that truth with what you remember.
I know Horus Lupercal was a better man than any other I met. He would never turn on his father.
You do not really believe that.
Don't tell me what I believe.
You do not believe it because if Horus was ever to turn on his father, you know this is exactly how he would do it. A sudden, shocking betrayal, followed by an apparently suicidal gambit that results in the massacre of the Emperor's best chance to stop the rebellion before it gains momentum.
Severian said nothing, knowing Nagasena was right. What little he knew of the massacre at Istvan V was just the grand guignol with which Horus would open a rebellion.
I do not lie. On the blade, Shujiki. I swear it.
Then why have you not shot me from the cliff?
Perhaps I will before you reach Vadok Singh's villa.
I don't think so.
Severian resumed his climb.
Then let us say that Horus may be a traitor, but I do not yet know if you are.
Nagasena's voice faded from the helm, lost in a squall of interference from a test firing of the palace's void generators. Severian continued climbing, drawing closer to the top. With each moment of ascent, he wondered if Nagasena would shoot him from the cliff, but quickly dismissed the possibility. If Nagasena wanted to kill him, he would be dead already. The sun was gone now, and only the faint haze of starlight and the arc lights from the Babha work camps and the Mechanicum ship forges on the Terai Dua flatlands illuminated the rock face. As he approached the lip of the cliff, he pressed his cheek to the black rock and focused his gaze on the boundary between stone and sky. Sure enough, he saw a wavering bloom of disturbed air. The faint haze of a laser tripwire covered the full length of the cliff edge. Severian took a firm grip of the rock in one hand and let himself dangle. He turned himself around and re-established his handholds as he braced his feet flat against the cliff, knees bent, muscles tense. He took a shallow breath and gathered his concentration, visualizing the planned movement in his head, rehearsing the duration of each muscle contraction and snap of limb until he was certain of its success. Severian pushed off, powering his legs out and up, using his handhold as a hinge about which his body arced like the overpowered swing of a pendulum. Halfway through, he released his grip and twisted his body, snapping around in a gymnast's crunch. He landed a meter beyond the edge of the cliff and dropped to his knees in a sandy courtyard. One hand pressed flat to the ground, the other balled into a fist. He awaited the scream of an alarm, the hue and cry of a sentry, or the chatter of an automated weapon system. Nothing. Only the sigh of the wind and the hiss of his own breath disturbed the silence.
I expected better from you, War Mason. If you are Dorne's architect, then the War Master will simply walk into the Emperor's throne room.
The courtyard was enclosed on three sides by tiered steps that led up to an enclosing cloister. Night-blooming plants with albino leaves spread themselves to the moon, and their bitter almond scent hinted at bespoke genecraft. A stone-flagged path led around the edges of the courtyard, at the center of which gurgled and frothed a fountain, topped by a finial of a square and compass. the numerous branches of the path enclosed rectangles of sand in which were rendered miniature sections of construction models of blockhouses, elevations and bastions. Intersecting lines of fire and dead zones were marked in the sand, together with guild markings that made no sense to Severian. He recognized the Dawalagiri in one, the Eternity Gate in another, and the growing fortification spreading at the opening of the Mohan. Severian ascended to the cloister, padding softly over the polished terrazzo. The heads of the flowers followed his movements. He followed the cloister to the villa's central pavilion, a wide elevation with a tall tower at its heart, from which the war mason could survey his great works. The landing platform and Singh's tilt-jet shuttle were on a raised plateau to the front of the main building. Severian had only the most basic knowledge of operating such a craft. He could fly it, but not well enough to avoid the inevitable interceptors and their seeker warheads. No, if he was to reach the orbital plates alive, he needed to give his pursuers a reason not to shoot him down. What better a reason than the Emperor's own war mason? Severian paused, sensing a subtle, undefinable change in the air. The smell of almonds had vanished, replaced by something ammoniac. Instantly, his hand flashed to his blade, and he pressed himself against the wall. A panel beside him slid open, and a multi-barreled cannon pushed out on a circular gimbal mount. A green-lensed rangefinder tracked across the courtyard, and Severian saw its twin emerge from the opposite wall. Its tracker beam panned across him, and green flashed to red. A blitz of shells hammered the air, and he pushed off the wall as the cannon beside him spun around. He sprang up and wrenched the barrel, its bucking motion like wrestling a greenskin. Its servos fought him, but he kept his grip firm and walked its fire into the opposite cannon. High-velocity shells ripped through it, tearing it from the wall in a blaze of impacts. Severian jammed his blade into the cannon's rotator mechanism and threw himself to the side as the shells exploded in the breach, ripping the weapon apart in a spray of wild shots. He rolled to his feet and ran to the edge of the cloister. Vaulting from one of its supporting pillars, he swung up and hauled himself onto the tiled roof as more guns unmasked below. Movement was his only ally here. He ran along the ridge of the cloister's roof as a wailing siren blared in alarm and light flooded the mountainside. Previously concealed arc lights swung up and bathed the villa in blazing illumination that left him no shadow. More of the night-blooming flowers were situated at regular intervals in ornate planters. Spores misted their heads and Severian gagged at the stench, now realizing how he had been unmasked so swiftly. These were bioengineered plants, presumably tailored to react to any unfamiliar genetic sample. Severian vaulted onto the higher roof of the main structure as four figures emerged from cavities worked into the lower reaches of the tower. Automata, rendered in glossy black flex metal and moving with a suppleness that only connections to the high magi of the Mechanicum could procure. Superficially human, their heads were mannequin blank, concealing a lethal array of combat wetware grafted to the cauterized remains of a human cerebral cortex. Each was armed with a long whipping blade and an implanted energy weapon. Two of them came straight for him, the third and fourth taking to the air on repulsor packs. A flurry of shots silenced the air. Severian ducked and rolled, knowing on an instinctual level where their targeters would aim. He ran towards the first, drawing and firing a Black Sentinel's pistol in one motion. The weapon was ridiculously small in his grip, but the nearest automaton went down, its head broken open. The second sprang away to the side, right into the arcing grenade Severian had thrown at the same instant. The detonation sent it spinning down into the courtyard in flames. A shot struck him in the back, and he grunted in pain as the beam punched through his armor. His old warplate would have stopped the shot, but this was armor of an earlier age. He rolled and came up firing. automata had spread out. Its shots punched empty air. Severian kept moving, hearing the clatter of yet more emplaced sentinels being thrown into the fray. Escalating threat response. The more he killed, the more would come at him. Another shot struck him, and this time searing heat burned him, a cauterized wound. Severian turned as he heard the buzz of an approaching enemy. The blank-faced automaton crashed down beside him, and Severian swung two pistols to bear. It struck out with its implanted blade, skewering him through his lower ribs. He slammed his fist down, snapping the blade at the root, and emptied one pistol's magazine onto the automaton. The impacts battered it down the slope of the roof, but pitch-perfect balanced gyros kept it from toppling over the edge. It took aim at him, but a grenade at its feet blew it off the roof in a cascade of broken tires and fire. Severian wrenched the flex blade from his body as the fourth automaton dropped down 10 meters behind him. It had seen the destruction of the first three and was in no hurry to share their fate. Severian ran towards the tower, chased by weapons fire. Shots blistered the air around him as he saw more of the blank-faced sentinels circling the tower. Severian skidded to a halt, dropping to a crouch. His arm lifted and shot forward. Black nanocarbon steel flashed, and the automaton went down with a bloodied flex blade punched through its skull. It crumpled to its knees, but Severian was already on the move. He dived into the recess from which the nearest of the automata had emerged. Yasunagasena watches the battle on the rooftop with a hunter's fascination. He is impressed that Severian has managed to penetrate this far. Vadok Singh dismissed his warning as unnecessary, yet here they stand in the War Mason's extremis chamber, surrounded by free-floating picture images generated by a holosphere. Vadok Singh is accompanied by a Migu pit-fighting creature and two of his glossy black automata. The warrior cyborgs were crafted in the forges of Magos Lucas Krom, a Mechanicum adept, now thought to be a traitor. Singh clearly values Krom's work over his reputation. The War Mason's body is tall and willowy, engineered for height and guild work. It looks too fragile and too breakable for Terran gravity. Nagasena has been in the presence of the Gene Forged many times, but something in Singh's form unnerves him more than any Primarch, Legionary, or Chimeric Mechanicum adept. Singh glances over at him, stroking the wax paper schemata Nagasena asked to see. His voice mixes irritation and admiration.
He is resourceful, but he is just one warrior.
One warrior who has evaded capture by the Emperor's custodians and the Black Sentinels. Trust me, you do not know this man.
Nor do you.
To hunt a man is to know him.
His presence here surely makes the truth of his words self-evident. Singh leans forward as an explosion on the rooftop blanks the screens for a fraction of a second. The War Mason frowns, tracking the pictures on the roof around in confusion. Severian is nowhere to be seen.
Where is he?
Nagasena has no answer for him. Severian has vanished, and he can do nothing trapped in the extremis chamber. He realizes it was a mistake to trust the War Mason's assurances that there were no blind spots in his defenses.
Open the door, now.
Singh sifts through myriad hollows with impatient haptic gestures.
Don't be ridiculous.
Open it. I need to be out there.
Singh taps a code into a floating keypad of light.
Very well. But this door will not open again. Not for you or anyone else.
I understand.
The meter's thick, armored blast door swings slowly open, and Nagasena slips through as soon as it is wide enough. The corridor is empty.